Well, good morning, everyone. We get a chance today to have a look at Zechariah chapter 7. Originally, I thought that we'd do something different for all of you that get tired of a study on a Saturday and you don't like it to continue on to the Sunday. Some people are always ready for something else by Sunday. But it just seemed like Zechariah 7 was a hard chapter to leave out of the flow of Zechariah 1 to 6 on the night visions. And I think you'll see why as you come along. Zechariah 7 a lot of times gets left out in our studies of Zechariah. Zechariah 7, Zechariah 8, a lot of people figure, well, it's not very prophetic, so it's not really like a study of prophecy in Zechariah. But what it is one of the key issues that has to be dealt with in our lives, in family life or ecclesial life. One of the key problems that has hit God's people from the beginning, ever since God set up mechanisms of worship. And that is the problem of what do you do with the rituals? What do you do in terms of like what happens over time when God establishes rituals for us to do, where we have the bread and the wine, we have our meetings and our services, we have our Bible readings in our home, we have baptisms, we have all the different types of rituals that he brings to our life, things that we go through, the procedures that we do. What happens when those things become so important that we lose track of why they were there? And Zechariah 7 is actually all about that. May not have caught that in the reading, but here's what happens in Zechariah 7. Just have a look at where we are. In Zechariah 7, we're in the fourth year of King Darius. Right? This is Darius or Darius Hystaspes, this king in which the temple was finally finished. Now, Zechariah and Haggai stirred up the people in the second year of Darius, and the temple was finished by the sixth year of Darius. So now we're in the fourth year. So when you look at in terms of where we are, we're halfway in between the time period in which the prophets got them stirred up, the people are back to work, 2 years have gone by, and there's only 2 years left to go. And so the temple work was progressing really fast. And now the people, the adversaries were having to pay for it. They were told to stay away and let the children of Israel finish this. And so the work on the temple began progressing pretty quick at this point, and people could start to see that this building's going to get finished. It really is going to happen. And so what happens in this chapter, it's fascinating to watch. But when you go down the line right here, that we're, the word of the Lord in chapter 7, it came to pass that the word of the Lord came to Zechariah on the fourth day of the ninth month when the people... Now, there's a little change in the English Bibles that most of us have right here, but if you look at an NASB or an RSV or an NIV or some of the other versions, you'll see that what happens here in verse 2, and you got to understand this, you got to see what's happening in the Hebrew. It's not that the New King James says the people sent Sherezer and Rigamilik and his men to the house of God to pray before the Lord. But really, that phrase, the house of God, is actually Bethel. And what really happened here, according to most of the Hebrew scholars of the commentaries, is that it was the people of Bethel who sent a delegation down to the house of God, as his house of God is getting finished. Now, they're working in Jerusalem on the house, they're getting the temple built, and these people that were in Bethel, remember where Bethel was? It was technically in the northern kingdom back earlier, sort of like right on the border. That was like right at the lower border of the northern kingdom, so that when you passed from Bethel and came a little bit further south, you would be in Judah. So it was like right on that borderline. Bethel was about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. And so these people that were only 10 miles away... 2 years now into this building project, you see, where it really got going gung-ho, 2 years into the building project, these people of Bethel, they send a delegation down to the house of God, down to pray before the Lord, and to ask the priests who belong to the house of the Lord and the prophet, saying, should I weep in the fifth month as I have done so for many years? Now, you can understand, you know, a little bit the question, should I weep in the fifth month? And again, in verse 5, you hear about the seventh month as well, that they had been mourning and fasting during the fifth and the seventh months. Well, you wonder, well, like, why were they weeping in the fifth month? What was going on here, that this bit about the weeping in the fifth month? And why would they be asking now, 2 years into the project, well, they're almost done here, we only got 2 years to go, and the temple's going to be finished. Why are they inquiring down here from Bethel about whether they should continue weeping? Well, when you go back and look and you find out why they were weeping, it was in the fifth month. If you just go back and have a look at a couple of references to note, Jeremiah chapter 1 is one of them. Where you can, if you like to do a little Bible marking it here. In Jeremiah chapter 1, in verse 3 of Jeremiah 1, Jeremiah lets us know in Jeremiah 1 at verse 3 that it came also when he was talking about when Jeremiah was prophesying. It says, it came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, until the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, until the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the fifth month. Fifth month, you see, that was the month in which they got carried away captive. If you go back to 2 Kings 25, just so you can see what was happening here, why this fifth month was such a big issue to them. In 2 Kings 25, what happened is that Nebuchadnezzar's reign actually had busted through the wall when Zedekiah was trying to escape through the wall, and Nebuchadnezzar captured him at this period here in the fifth month. And then this was the beginning of the end, really. This was at the end of that one and a half years where Jerusalem had been besieged. Remember how Jerusalem had been besieged for the year and a half and had been totally surrounded. Nobody was allowed to go in and out, and they were all locked up inside. They were locked up like a bird in a cage. And at the end of the year and a half, Zedekiah tries to rebel, digs a hole through the wall, tries to escape, and he gets tracked down. And remember how Zedekiah was taken, and his sons were killed, and his eyes were pulled out at that point. That was the last thing he ever saw because he had not listened to the word of Jeremiah. Well, in 2 Kings 25, verses 8 and 9, what happened when after they took out his eyes, they bound him in fetters and took him to Babylon. In verse 8, it says, now in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Lord and the king's house in the fifth month. And you can also find in Jeremiah 52, there's another reference that just backs this up, that on the 10th day, Nebuchadnezzar burned the temple, burned the king's house, and broke down the wall of the city. So, what had they been doing all this time? Ever since this happened back here in the 11th year of Zedekiah, these people had been commemorating in the fifth month that this was the month in which their community fell apart. Nebuchadnezzar, the captain of the guard, brought the army in. The siege was over. Zedekiah fell at this point. And the foreign nation, these uncircumcised Babylonians, came into the city, broke down the wall, and destroyed the temple. Something they thought was never going to happen. Never was going to have been there for like 500 years. And they figured there's no way God would ever let that happen. How would he ever let his house be destroyed? And so once that happened and the people were carried captive up to Babylon, what they did is that every year when that month came around, they fasted during that month. And they'd been keeping these fasts and it had been going on all the years that they were in Babylon. And now that they're back in the land, and here they are still fasting in the fifth month, and now they send a delegation down to ask, well, should we keep it up? Should we keep up this fasting? Now, can you imagine having an ecclesial project of the scale of this temple going up where you need everybody's help? Everybody's help. And you've got all these people working in this building project. And now we've got a city up here that sends a delegation down after another 2 years while this has been going on. And all these people are... Zechariah's prophecy had been given. Haggai's prophecy had been given. Everybody was encouraged and enthusiastic. And this temple's going to get built. Can you imagine being so out of touch that you have to send a delegation down to say, well, should we keep up this fasting? You want us to keep it going again? We've been doing it now for these 70 years. Should we keep it up? I just can't believe that. If you had been one of those members from Bethel and you had been involved in the building project, wouldn't that be the kind of thing you'd be talking about while you're building? You'd be asking one another what you've been doing. Should we keep it up? You know, is this something that do we need to do this anymore? You know, all excited about the building project. You get the sense that these people of Bethel were really out of touch. Really out of touch. They were like ecclesias that are like a little bit isolated off, and projects are going on, seminars are taking place, and it's like they don't even know what's going on. They're just like, they're not in tune with what's happening in ecclesial life. This is what this community was like. You're like brethren and sisters living in isolation and don't even realize what's happened in the ecclesia over the last year. Every so often they got to check in and find out what's actually happening. And so they send this delegation down and ask whether or not they should keep this up, and look at God's response. And you can see this response comes right in. It gives you a little bit of a flavor of what was actually happening. Say to all the people of the land. This isn't just Bethel. This is a problem that had been all throughout the community, but these people in Bethel were going to be the spokesmen of this situation. Say to all these people and to the priests, When you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh months during those 70 years, during that whole period ever since Jerusalem had fallen, and this 70-year period has been going for 70 years, every year they've been doing these fasts in the fifth month and the seventh month. When you did all these things, did you really do it for me? For me? Says God. Is that really what you were doing it for? When you were going through all these rituals, and you were showing up and having these meetings, and you were going through all these different services, and you were keeping those fasts, were you really doing that for me? I don't think so, you see. And God knew it. They really weren't doing it for him. For 70 years this had been going on. These people that were doing this now, a lot of them were probably children of the ones who had originally started it. And now it's been passed on from mom and dad to the next generation, and the next generation is going through the rituals. Not at all for God. They're just going through the motions. And boy, it's a scary thing in ecclesial life, brethren and sisters, that we can fall into the same trap. And to the young people that are here this morning, the young people, watch out. This is what can happen in ecclesial life. We find out, what did mom and dad do? What did grandma and grandpa do? And we go through the motions, and we're not doing it for God at all. We're doing it because it works for us. Maybe we like having the eating meetings where we come together and, well, they serve snacks at this ecclesia between meeting and Sunday school, you see. We go to this study day and, ooh, they give us nice food, warm meals, you see. And we can start making decisions about where we're going, CYC, meeting, Sunday school, whatever it is, study days, on the basis of all the peripheral things of going through the motions without having any really understanding or interest in doing it for God. That's sad, but that's what happened with these people. And when you look back over the history of Israel, that was the big problem that developed that the prophets had to deal with. People going through the motions, not doing it for God, they were doing it for themselves. You look at verse 6, when you eat and when you drink. See, they were having their parties. They were at the end of these fasts. You go through a fast for a few days, or you fast for a day or so. And then after the fast, big party, you see. When you went through all this and you ate and you drank, and some of their feasts that they were holding, you know, you did it for yourselves. It wasn't for me. That isn't why you were doing it. Should you not, in verse 7, have obeyed the words which Yahweh proclaimed through the former prophets, when Jerusalem and the cities around were inhabited and prosperous, and the south and the lowland were inhabited? Shouldn't you have listened to the prophets? The prophets warned you. God didn't want these rituals. He wanted people to obey him and to do his word and to treat one another with kindness. You look at verse 9. Verse 9 is the epitome of what we're here for today. This is what God wants from us today. He doesn't really want us to take bread and wine. The bread and the wine are the reminder of the promise, the covenant we've made with our Lord to join him with his death to sin, to put this old man to death, and to treat one another like he would treat one another. That's what we're joining in him in his death to sin, not giving in to the old man. And this is the reminder of the promise, the covenant that we made. And we need that reminder week by week. But this is not the issue. The issue is living the truth. Look at verse 9. This is what God had wanted. Execute true justice. Show mercy and compassion, everyone, to his brother. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the alien or the poor. Let none of you plan evil in his heart against his brother. You see, and the problem for all of us, brothers and sisters and young people, is that we can come to meeting and we can take the rituals and we can go away thinking evil in our heart about one another. That's sad, but it's real. And this is one of the great warnings of the Bible. And here it comes right in the midst of all the enthusiasm going on of building this temple. We're only 2 years away. You can see the building going up and everybody's working together in ecclesial life. And there's this element of people scattered all throughout the land who are still going through the motions. And they're really not part of the project. And you can see that because they were so out of touch. Or they would have been asking while they were down there working on the project. And that's what can happen. And it's just a warning to ourselves that if we fall out of ecclesial life, we're not involved anymore. We don't really realize what's happening. We don't know what's going on in the CYCs, in the Sunday schools, and all the different seminars that are happening, and all the ecclesial events. We're sort of like really out on the outskirts. We really don't know what's happening, and we're not there to talk to people. So what do? We make the official phone call, or we write the official letter, or we find out something. Because if we had been there, we'd be talking to people. We'd be finding out about these things and talking these issues out. And I think that's pretty typical of what happened with these people back then. They were just out-of-touch folks up there 10 miles away in Bethel, and here they send their delegation down, but they're typical of a problem that was all throughout the community. And that's why the message went out in verse 5, say to all the people of the land and to the elders and to the priests that when you fasted, and he goes on and explains the whole point. You may wonder, like, why the seventh month comes up. The best solutions I've seen on the seventh month are the suggestions that are put forward as to why they picked the fifth and the seventh months. When you're back in 2 Kings 25, it's probably just worth noting because in 2 Kings 25, verses 8 and 9 refer to the fifth month. And verse 25 refers to the fact that in the seventh month, that was when Ishmael rebelled and killed Gedaliah and the Jews at Mizpah. And then the people fled on down to Egypt at that point. And that was one of the events that they may have looked back to. It's also mentioned in Jeremiah 41. So it's possible it's that event. Or it may be something that was somehow related to the temple back in Israel's history that we don't really know. Because they specifically ask about the fifth month. When God responds, he mentions the fifth and the seventh months that they were doing. And in fact, when you get into chapter 8, if you just glance over at chapter 8 and verse 19, God just covers them all in one time. He just writes them all off and says, you know, this is what he really had intended. In chapter 8 at verse 19, thus says the Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth month, and the fast of the seventh month, and the fast of the tenth month shall be joy and gladness and cheerful feasts for the house of Judah. Therefore, love, truth, and peace. And so he seems to cover them all. These were the fasts that they were keeping, the fourth, the fifth, the seventh, and the tenth. All these fasts that they were going through, these ritual keepings of fasts that were memorials to them of all the trouble that they had gone through at the time of the captivity. And you look back and you think, well, why were they doing all these fasts? You know, they liked the parties. They liked the fact that you could feast afterwards and have the social gatherings. But what it boils down to is that it was really stuff for themselves. These were fasts that satisfied a need that they probably had, maybe in one in which, you know, there was a lot of self-pity. They would get together for the day and they would fast and they would mourn over the fact of, look at how bad things are. Look at how much trouble we've been through. And look at what we've had to endure over the last 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. And all the focus was on me, you see. And it wasn't on what we can do to help other people. What can we do for God today? All the focus became down on me. And I think that's the warning that we find in the Bible, is that when you see in your life that the events of your life, the activities that you do, you know, the way you structure your life is built around me and poor me and, you know, all the trouble I've been through, or, you know, the focus is on me, whether it's me positive or me negative, what can end up happening is we get out of balance and we've got to get back and have a look at what did God intend. In fact, on the fast, it's probably not a bad idea to just note that there's a really good chapter in Isaiah 58 on the fast. And when it comes up in the New Testament, like when Jesus is talking about fasting as well, it's a great chapter that illustrates what God had really intended with fasting. In fact, the New King James Bible actually puts as its heading for this section in Isaiah 58, and the subheadings, they call it the fasting that pleases God. And what this chapter deals with is people that were going through the rituals. Right? They were just going through the rituals of fasting without doing it for God. And you find, like, at verse 3 right there, when they talk about fasting, you know, why have we fasted, they say, and you do not see. We have afflicted our souls, and you take no notice. In fact, the day of your fast, you find pleasure, you see. You exploit all your laborers. Indeed, you fast for strife and debate, and you to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. The fasting that they were doing was one in which they would fast and they would exploit other people so they could have their fast. They'd have somebody else doing their work for them on that day when they weren't eating and they weren't working, and they would make sure somebody else covered for them. And they were doing it in such a way that all the focus was on them. Everybody had to work for them, and they exploited the other workers, the other slaves that they had, or the folks that were working for them. But in verse 6, what you find is that here's what God had intended. When we read about fasting in the Bible, and we read about the fast that God wants, this is it. Is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, that you may break every yoke? See, on a fast day, when you don't need to eat and you're going to go through fast, there's no reason to have your laborers out there working for you and your food that day and preparing meals or whatever. This is a day to give people a break and to set some people free. Is it not in verse 7 when you have a fast? Isn't the point of it to share your bread with the hungry? If you're not eating today, give your food to somebody else. That's what God had wanted them to do. Feed the poor, that you may bring to your house the poor who are cast out. And when you see the naked, that you cover him and not hide yourself from your own flesh. See, but that is not what these people were into at all. It was all focused around themselves, not understanding at all the point. What was the point? What's the point of the bread and the wine and the ritual of the bread and wine? It isn't just to focus on me. It's to convince me to extend myself to other people. What can we do for others like Christ has done for us? And that's what the ritual should do. And sure, we have to make sure that we bring ourselves into subjection, as the Apostle Paul said, and it's a reminder of that. But part of that subjection is that we are out working for others, involved in ecclesial life, spreading the gospel, and working in God's vineyard. And he mentions in verse 8 that then when you call, the Lord will answer, and when you cry, and he will say, here I am. You see, if we do this, in verse 9 there, if you take away the yoke from your midst, and the pointing of the finger, and the speaking of the wickedness, and you extend your soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted, then your light shall dawn in darkness, and your darkness shall be as the noonday, and Yahweh will guide you continually. See, that was the goal of the fast. Not to focus on me, not to satisfy me, and not to have my party afterwards, but the point of the fast was to help other people. And you can imagine sometimes during fasting when people aren't eating, sometimes we get really, really grumpy when we don't eat. And it was probably a great time for people to say some nasty things about one another and don't bother me, you know, I haven't eaten all day. And that kind of thing would come up. And God was saying, this isn't what he intended at all. This was supposed to be an opportunity of sharing what you had with other people. So that's the kind of thing that had gone wrong here in Zechariah chapter 7. And imagine it from God's perspective, you know, of looking at here this house was going up and the work was continuing on and everybody was pumped up about it. And people all throughout the land were just going through the motions and they weren't on the same page as him at all. Just going through the motions and it didn't have any meaning. What God wanted in fasting is he wanted people to do things for others. So sure, you're going to give up something for yourself, but not just to sit there and oppressed and feel like, oh, it's a rough day for me, I'm fasting. But it was an opportunity to take that day and spend it on other people, a day in God's service. So what had happened is that, at least at this time, as was typical of Israel's history, is that the religion had turned into one that the Apostle Paul would write to Timothy about and say that they had a form of godliness. They were going through the motions, but it didn't have any power to change their life. Paul mentions that in 2 Timothy 3. He talks about a religion that's out there where you can have a form of godliness. You're going through the motions. We show up to the meetings, maybe. We take the bread and the wine. Maybe we go to CYC. We attend the Sunday schools. But it's all around of what can I get out of it? And there's no extending of ourselves to others. And if we're doing it for that, if we are, it may be a place to get started as younger people where we get involved and we get started that way. But eventually we need to extend that beyond to just the focus on me and realize that this is really, we're doing this for God. We're doing this for others and the people that we can bring to God at that time. So don't let our religion become one which is just full of formalism. And when you look at what they should have been doing those 70 years, what God says they should have been doing is executing true justice, showing mercy and compassion, and not oppressing the fatherless and the widows and the poor and the aliens, and not planning evil in their heart against their brothers. But what they had done in Zechariah 7, you see, they had refused to hear the words of the prophets. And this is why, as Christadelphians, as we encourage Bible readings in our homes. We talk about the Bibles. You're going through those no questions right now, and some of you are. And it makes you really get down to think about, what did this mean? What are the important points right here? And we try to understand what those people were going through, as we did with Zechariah yesterday. And what were the lessons that we can learn from those people? Because that's what's going to change our lives in the end. And we got to listen to those prophets that were before. If they had listened to the prophets, then these people wouldn't have gone through all this trouble in this captivity. But you find it in Zechariah 7 at verse 11 there that these people back before that could have listened to the Jeremiahs and the Micahs and the Zephaniahs, and they could have listened to these prophets, but instead they shrugged their shoulders, stopped their ears, didn't want to hear anymore, didn't want to hear it because it involved too much of their life. And they made their hearts like, that means that word there, it means like diamonds. hard rock diamonds. That's what their hearts were like. And God couldn't change it. He couldn't get in there and soften it up. And what else could he do but pull them out of the land for 70 years and bring them back and hope that by then the new generation had softened hearts. And that's what he tried to do. You find that in verse 13 there, that it, just as it happened, he says, or therefore it happened, that verse 13 is one of those funny verses in the Bible where you see a little bit of sarcasm that's there, how God treats us in the sense as we treat him. Really what's there in the Hebrew is, therefore it happened that just as he called to them through the prophets and they wouldn't listen, he says right back at them that when you call to me, I'm not going to listen to you either. And I'm going to treat you just like you treated me. When I tried to talk to you through my prophets, you didn't want to hear. And now when you're ready to talk to me, I'm not going to listen either. And that's exactly the way the Hebrew reads. They're the exact same words. It's just a flip-flop from one to the other. And he says that in verse 14, what he had to do then was scatter them amongst the nations. And that was the reason for the captivity, because he could not break through these diamond hearts that these people had. So the warning that's there for us, brothers and sisters, in this is that don't let the rituals of the truth, don't let the meetings, don't let the bread and the wine, don't let even baptism can become a ritual. Don't let the rituals of the truth become the things that we elevate up there as being the key important items. Those are supposed to develop in us the important things of being kind and patient and helpful to other people and showing justice and mercy and revealing the character of God to other people. And if we don't find those rituals doing that in us, then we have a form of religion of which has lost its power. No power to change our lives. And don't ever be satisfied with that. If that's us right now today, we got to do something different this week. Something has to change, that the rituals don't take over our lives and become the big issues. You see, in Zechariah chapter 8, this continues actually on in this whole issue right there. The word comes to him in Zechariah 8 to remind that, yes, he's zealous for Zion with great zeal and with great fervor. And yes, he is, in verse 3, going to return to Zion and dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. This is where God intends to be. But the reason he's going to be in Zion and Jerusalem isn't so that we can just go through the motions. It's so that God will be in us. He'll be in our hearts, and he'll live in our hearts by faith. And we'll become different kinds of people, not just going through the motions. You look at the promise that he gave them in verse 4, that in that day, in verse 4, thus says Yahweh of armies, you see, he's going to be the army that's going to protect the people in that day. The old men and the old women will again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each one with his staff in his hand because of great age. That people are going to live to an older age now. They're not going to die off early anymore because of lack of food or pestilence or trouble in the city. And the street's going to be full of boys and girls playing in the streets. Whereas at this present time, they were, you know, when this was all happening, when the visions were given, they weren't sure they could do that. It really wasn't safe to let your child go out and play in the streets. You weren't sure what those adversaries were going to do, the Samaritans that were around. How do you know with all the intimidation going on and the hiring of the counselors against them? It really wasn't safe to do that. But God predicted the time was coming when it will be safe. And in verse 6, it's a fun little section right in there. Thus says Yahweh of armies there, if it is marvelous, the New King James has there, but the word really means too difficult. It's used in Jeremiah as well. If it's too difficult in the eyes of the remnant of these people in these days, will it also be too difficult in my eyes, says the Lord of hosts. In other words, you might be thinking this is going to be tough to pull off, and you can't really envision how this could ever happen, how you could have safety in Jerusalem, how you could be free to let your children play in the streets, and how all these things could happen. You might be thinking right now it's too difficult for God to do this in your life, but if you think it's too difficult, don't you ever think it's too hard for God. He said, it's not too hard for me. He's going to pull this off. Because, as he goes on in verse 7, he's going to save his people from the land of the east. He's going to bring them back, as some had already come back. He's going to bring even more back. And they will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and he will be their God, and they will be his people. But it's going to be in truth and in righteousness, you see, not in just going through the motions. And so, verse 9, let your hands be strong. Those of you that have been hearing in these days by the words of the mouth of the prophets, who were in the day that the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts, that the temple might be built. For before these days, there were no wages for man, nor hire for beasts. There was no peace from the enemy who went out before or came in. And I had, for I have set all men, everyone against his neighbor. Remember those days, what it was like back before, you know, like we looked at in Haggai yesterday, when you used to go out and work and there was there were holes in the pockets and the economic situation was bad and all that trouble was there. Well, he says, now things are going to be different. I'm not going to treat the remnant anymore like I did those people in those days. And now what's going to happen, God says, because you're out working and you're building and you're finishing this house, that the seed shall be prosperous, the vine shall give its fruit, the ground shall give her increase, the heavens will give their due, and I will cause the remnant of this people to possess all these things. And it will come to pass that just like you were a curse among the nations, the house of Judah and the house of Israel, so I will save you, and you will be a blessing. Do not fear, let your hands be strong. 2 more years to go, you see, at this point. And the encouragement comes through, keep up the good work, keep going, we're going to finish this project. And God will turn everything around to where all the other nations that used to laugh at you and say, ha, ha, look at those Jews that, they're, you know, God let them go captive out of their land. Now these people are going to be grabbing the hold of a robe of a Jew saying, let's go with you, because we've heard that Yahweh your God is with you. And that's the way he finishes up this chapter. And you see again in verse 14 and 15 that it's just as I determined to punish you and your fathers provoked me to wrath. Now he says in these latter days, now I'm determined to do you good. Good to Jerusalem, good to the house of Judah, do not fear. But these are the things that you shall do. And here we're going to come again, brothers and sisters, to this focal point in our exhortation this morning and the reminder to us, don't count on the rituals. The rituals were designed to bring about the right spirit in us that we would actually live the truth. So he says, don't be afraid, but here's what you have to do. God's going to take care of all the political things. God's going to take care of the economic things. What we have to do is speak each man truth to his neighbor. Tell the truth to one another. Give judgment in your gates for truth and justice and peace. You know, treat one another with equity. Don't be treating one way and one another way, but do it with justice and truth and peace. And verse 17, let none of you think evil in your heart. Here we go again, that same phrase that was back in chapter 7 at verse 10. Don't let any of you think evil in your heart against your neighbor, and do not love a false oath. For all these things are things that I hate, says the Lord. And then he goes on and says, all this fasting is going to be overturned to joy. Nations are going to come back to Jerusalem and seek the Lord of hosts in verse 22 and grab hold of a Jew because they had heard that God is with them. But our reminder this morning, brothers and sisters, and really for the entire weekend, is that God only expects us to do our part. They would never have been able to get this building project finished if they were doing it in their own strength. It wasn't going to be by my might and by my spirit. It was going to be by God's, by his spirit, not by our power, not by our might, but by God's spirit that this building was going to go up. And that lesson needs to come into our lives, into our families, into our homes, that we only need to do our part. And our part is to obey God, to do our Bible readings in our home, and to learn from those, to treat one another with kindness, to extend mercy, the mercy that Christ has extended to us this morning. The reminder that's there in the bread and the wine is so that we will go away and we'll extend that same mercy to each other and treat one another as our God has treated us. Those are the things that we can do. That's within us to do those things. And all the big things that are beyond our power, the angels are out there to take care of those things, and we can count on them to do their part if we're willing to do ours. And that's, I think that's the concept that he wants to get out of this chapter. So, brethren and sisters, as we partake the emblems this morning, let's just reflect over some of the lessons that we picked up this weekend and make sure we go home this week continuing to work in God's service, building his house in our families, working with our children, our CYCs, the young people, being the one to volunteer, as so many of you in this ecclesia do, to get involved in the school or get involved in the youth camp. And it's such a great spirit to see of people that are willing to work in God's spiritual house and asking for God's help along the way. And being aware of the angels that are there to help us, because we know we can't do it all. And as we take the emblems this morning, let's remember to join with our Lord in his struggle against sin. This is really how we show forth his death until he comes. It's not by eating bread and wine. It's by taking the principles of the bread and wine. And this morning, as we drink the wine and we eat the bread, and then we literally live them out this week, and that's how we show forth his death to sin. until he comes, by how we treat one another, how we respond to our God, how much we are aware of the angels, and how much we're willing to subdue this old man within us because we really want to put forth his death to sin in ourselves. And may we appreciate this morning, brothers and sisters, the grace and the mercy of our God. As you see that capstone going up, that final stone, that what holds the entire building together, the whole ecclesia this morning, the whole community of Christadelphians together, is it's all based on grace. Grace to it, because there's nothing we could have ever done to deserve the opportunity. And all we can do is our part, where we respond in kindness and in love to our God to put his principles into practice in our homes, our families, and our ecclesias.